regularly scheduled election.
If you're a student in high school and you have policies actively targeting you and your humanity, that's your entire high school career. You don't get to wait another 4 years and say, don't worry.
Now, conservatives see this differently. They say this is simply a case of powerful unions who did not like recent election results, didn't like who ended up on the school board, and are now trying to engineer a different result in special elections.
So, Guy, what are your big takeaways from your reporting on this?
Well, I think this, you know, organized pushback that we're seeing to these conservative board members was not necessarily a given a year ago. There were a lot of questions about how opponents of these board members were going to respond. We'll have to see how the results shake out in Temecula this week and in Sonol next month. But I do think regardless of the results, it's clear that opponents of these conservative board members have had a bit of a wake-up call. You know, they're now vowing to take these school board seats more seriously, contest them in general elections. And oh, by the way, Republican officials I talked to said they're just as committed to winning these seats in the future. So I think you can expect this fight to continue, perhaps escalate as we move towards November.
That's KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati. Guy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Madi.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at Irvine.org. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at SchmidtOcean.org.
And that's the California Report for Monday, June 3rd. We're a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Madi Bolaños. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Moving towards 6, we'll have more Morning Edition and KQED News in a minute after Mel with traffic in Vallejo now.
37 westbound between the Mare Island Bridge and the lane merge. We're starting to see the usual stop-and-go traffic there, an indication of a pretty normal traffic morning. The normal delays on Highway 4 westbound in the Pittsburgh area, and on 580 westbound through the Altamont Pass, 205 to North Flynn Road, that stop-and-go. It's heavy on the other side of the pass as well. Mel Baker for KQED.
Monday traffic support comes to us from Murphy McKenna Construction. Join KQED today for a new week of the afternoon news quiz, 5:48 p.m. Monday through Friday. Join us this afternoon. When you hear the quiz question, go to kqed.org/radio news quiz to enter your answer for a chance to win a two-night stay at Canyon Ranch Woodside. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. Thank you for listening. You're on member-supported KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands, Sacramento. Now 6 a.m.
Good morning. Former President Trump's allies demand loyalty after his felony conviction in New York. What does that mean for Republican candidates who are not named Trump? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, the first big wildfire of the season near Tracy is now 50% contained. I'm Brian Watt.
How much power can states wield over the internet? I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. New York State wants to keep social media algorithms away from kids. And how did Napster transform music? The music sharing site started 25 years ago. How much safer is a Ukrainian city now that its defenders can fire U.S.-made weapons into Russia? It's Monday, June 3rd. This day in 1989, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khomeini died. His government remains in power. Also in 1989, Chinese troops began crushing pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Cross-border fire has increased in recent weeks along the Israel-Lebanon border. Israel has completed military exercises to prepare for another possible war, as NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
Hezbollah and Lebanon fired at Israel at the start of the Gaza war, and the two sides have been waging a low-grade war ever since. Now, violence is increasing. Israeli warplanes bombed Hezbollah sites in Lebanon over the weekend, and recent rockets from Hezbollah sparked fires in Israeli-held territory. Israel says all branches of its military took part in exercises last week to prepare for a potential war along Israel's northern front with Lebanon. President Biden is urging a ceasefire deal in Gaza, which he says can lead to calm along the Israel-Lebanon border. But some Israeli officials are calling for a war, including the conservative education minister, who says an Israeli offensive should push Hezbollah militants and Lebanese civilians further north away from Israel's border. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The U.S. is putting pressure on Hamas as well as Israel to end the war in Gaza, raging for nearly 8 months. Last week, President Biden revealed the Israeli ceasefire proposal. Former President Donald Trump says he's, quote, okay if he gets jail time or home confinement for his criminal fraud convictions in New York State. But he told Fox News in an interview that aired yesterday his supporters could reach a, quote, breaking point. He didn't explain. NPR's Andrea Bernstein reports, meanwhile, Trump's lawyers are starting his appeal process.
After the jury came back with a decision last week, the defense moved to set aside the verdict. Judge Mershon said firmly, that motion is denied, but they can file more post-trial motions. Judge Mershon gave them a deadline of June 13th, Thursday of next week, and prosecutors have 2 weeks after that to respond. That day, June 27th, is the day of the first presidential debate.
NPR's Andrea Bernstein reporting. California firefighters are working to contain a blaze burning about 60 miles east of San Francisco. From member station KQED, Catherine Monahan reports the blaze broke out over the weekend and prompted evacuations.
Travis Curtis is sitting in a gas station parking lot with other evacuees. It's the last stop before a roadblock, and on the other side is whatever remains of his parents' house.
Now we're waiting to get clearance to be able to go in and, you know, basically rip off the Band-Aid and see how bad it is. But from what we've been told by other news crews who have seen the property, there's the foundation, and that is it.
Police ordered over 200 households to evacuate Saturday. Curtis says his parents left with only their tortoise, two dogs, and a bag of clothes. They're hoping their insurance can arrange housing for them while they decide whether to rebuild. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Monahan in Tracy.
This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. It's about to get hot. Starting tomorrow, some inland parts of the Bay Area could reach the mid to upper 90s. The rising temperatures could melt what's left of the state's dwindling snowpack. KQED science editor Kevin Stark reports.
The Weather Service says this will be the first prolonged heat wave of the year across the West. For California, it will be felt most acutely in the Sierra Nevada in the northern part of the state, with potentially record-breaking temperatures for June. After a blissfully normal water year, the state's snowpack has dwindled to below 50%. UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain.
It's very possible the upcoming heat wave will pretty much kill off what's left.
He says that could jumpstart the state's fire season and potentially elevate the risk later on this summer. I'm Kevin Stark, KQED News.
The Marin County Board of Supervisors is scheduled to consider funding a wage increase for in-home caregivers tomorrow. KQED's Christopher Allam has more.
The tentative agreement between In-Home Supportive Services Public Authority, or IHSS, and SEIU Local 2015 would boost the hourly wage for more than 2,000 workers. That would represent a boost to $19 an hour starting in August, with 25-cent increases each year. Coupled with anticipated minimum wage increases, the Marin County executive predicts wages would hit $21 per hour by the start of 2027. The agreement also provides some incentives for workers in West Marin who may have to travel substantial distances to reach their clients. I'm Christopher Allam, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more Bay Area news at kqed.org.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Storyworth. Each week, Storyworth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at storyworth.com. And by the listeners and members of KQED. Bay Area traffic now at 6:06.
And let's look at transit. There is on BART a Green Line service outage today due to planned track maintenance work. A bus bridge is in place between Daly City and 24th Street. Also, VTA light rail service is being replaced by a bus bridge between Blossom Hill and the Tamian stations due to track maintenance there. Mel Baker, for KQED.
Coming up, KQED News. Brian Watt returns at 6:22. Ahead for you, the Oakland Ballers' first home game is sold out, which means more than 4,000 people will be showing up in West Oakland. Ahead at 6:22 and again at 8:22 on this Monday, we'll give you a look at what the Ballers are doing to encourage fans not to drive to the game. Join us here with KQED News on KQED Public Radio. As reported, heat warning starts for the Bay Area tomorrow. For the Sacramento Valley, it also starts with a heat warning around 11 a.m. It's going to get hot in Northern California tomorrow, Wednesday. Look for Bay Area highs today in the mid-60s, close to 80 in some parts inland. Look for partly cloudy skies tonight, lows in the 40s and 50s. And then mostly sunny skies tomorrow as temperatures start to increase. Tomorrow's highs in the Bay Area, 70s to the upper 90s are forecast. Cloudy today, Sacramento highs 80 to 88. Tomorrow highs 98 to possibly 104.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. We find out this fall how, if at all, former President Trump's criminal conviction affects his bid to return to the White House. We also find out what voters think of candidates who demonstrated their loyalty by denouncing the jury verdict. They include Kerry Lake of Arizona, one of the Republicans aiming to help their party recapture the Senate.
This will go down as a stain in American history. It's called lawfare, and it will only make Trump stronger.
How does Republicans' fealty affect them? David Wasserman is senior editor and elections analyst for the Cook Political Report, which is a nonpartisan newsletter. Welcome back to the program, sir.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Okay, help me think this through politically. If you're a Republican, what is the political calculation of publicly rejecting this jury verdict?
Well, just to set the scene, Steve, to date, most Democrats have been running ahead of Joe Biden down ballot because they have their own brands and they're more personally popular than Biden is. And in our polling in battleground states from mid-May, Trump was up 47-44 in six key battleground states, but Democratic Senate candidates were ahead, and the House ballot was tied at 44-44. And so it's been telling to see some of the reactions of these Republicans, and so far it suggests that they don't see any upside, those who are running in competitive states and districts, in telling voters to respect the verdict. To the contrary, some of them see upside in decrying what they say is the weaponization of the justice system. And this conviction might have some slight upside for down ballot Republicans, not in a major way, and it's going to take a while to gauge the impact on polling, but it's sparked tremendous anger among Trump's base, and to the extent turnout is a bit higher among those supporters of Trump's, it has the potential to lift all Republican votes. Where the conviction could cost Trump is among soft independents who would be hesitant about voting for a convicted felon, but they may not change their minds down ballot.
Oh, this is really interesting. I want to try to summarize what you've told me, Dave. You're telling me that Republicans broadly are not doing as well as their presidential candidate in surveys, and so by attaching themselves more firmly to their presidential candidate, they may feel they can pull themselves up a notch on the ladder. Is that it?
And in addition, many Republican candidates and committees have gotten a fundraising boost, not as decisively as Trump has himself in the aftermath of this, but they've been able to engage that Trump base more to raise money. And keep in mind that at a candidate level, Democrats have had an advantage to date in these races, particularly in House seats, where there's been a noticeable drop-off in Republican candidate fundraising since the speakership changed.
Let me ask about one critical race, though. In Maryland, which is a blue state, Larry Hogan, the rare Republican who could plausibly win, and he is the Senate candidate there for the Republican Party, urged people to respect the verdict, which is a normal thing that would normally have happened in most circumstances in the past. And this drew a harsh reaction from the Trump campaign, saying your campaign is over. Laura Trump, the former president's daughter-in-law, now co-chair of the Republican Party, said this about Larry Hogan. Let's listen.
He doesn't deserve respect of anyone in the Republican Party at this point, and quite frankly, anybody in America.
I can think of other occasions where the president or presidential candidate would be okay if somebody in their party had to keep their distance. Why not this time?
Larry Hogan's in an extremely unique situation. He is running in a state that Joe Biden carried by more than 30 points last time. And so Hogan needs Democratic voters to get to his win number. It's unlikely he will at this point, given that the Democratic nominee, Angela Alsobrooks, has a bit of halo after winning the primary. But what's more telling is the reaction of Republicans in more evenly divided states and districts. We're not seeing them say the same thing that Hogan did. And it suggests that public opinion about this trial and conviction is very closely aligned to the breakdown of support in the presidential race to begin with. And the reaction of Lake, who, it's not surprising, she's one of Trump's most hardcore supporters anywhere on the Senate battlefield, it shows that she needs to get closer to Trump's number in Arizona in order to win. After all, she is running behind him at the moment.
David Wasserman is with the Cook Political Report. Thanks very much, as always, for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Take care.
Today in federal court in Delaware, jury selection begins in the Hunter Biden trial on gun charges.
This case against the president's son was brought by Justice Department Special Counsel David Weiss. Just last week, former President Trump was in the spotlight denouncing the jury verdict against him in a Democratic state. Now, trial begins for a Biden as part of an investigation that dates back to President Trump's administration.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is joining us now. Ryan, a gun case against Hunter Biden here, but what are the charges he's facing?
So there are three charges against Hunter here that all relate to a Colt Cobra revolver that he bought in October of 2018. He faces two counts of making false statements when purchasing the weapon. Prosecutors say that Hunter lied on a federal background check form he had to fill out when buying the gun. That form has a boilerplate question that asks whether you use illegal drugs or are addicted to drugs. Prosecutors say that Hunter lied on that form by checking the no box, in other words, saying that he wasn't using illegal drugs when prosecutors say he was. And then there's, of course, also the third count, and that is for the unlawful possession of a firearm by a drug user or addict.
Okay, how do prosecutors intend to prove their case?
Well, they've said in filings in an open court that they expect to call around a dozen witnesses. That includes Hunter's ex-wife, Kathleen Buell, as well as the widow of his brother, Beau, Haley Biden. Hunter had a romantic relationship with her after Beau died. Prosecutors say that Haley Biden will testify that Hunter had the gun in question, that she threw it into a dumpster outside a market in Wilmington less than 2 weeks after he bought it. That gun was later found by a man collecting recyclables. He's the one who turned it over to law enforcement. Prosecutors also intend to use parts of Hunter's own memoir as evidence, as well as Hunter's own text messages related to his drug use. But to be clear, Hunter has been very open, including in his memoir, about his addiction to crack cocaine, to alcohol. But this trial looks like it's going to put that struggle and the toll that it took on the Biden family very much in the national spotlight.
All right, now how will Hunter Biden's attorneys plan to counter the government's case?
Well, they think they can challenge some of the evidence. There has been, though, it has to be said, a lot of legal wrangling in the lead up to this trial. Hunter's attorneys have tried to get this case dismissed on a bunch of different grounds. The judge has denied those. But this time last year, it looked like Hunter was going to be able to avoid trial entirely. He had a tentative deal to plead guilty to misdemeanor tax charges and to avoid prosecution entirely on the gun charges. But that deal fell apart dramatically in court. Weeks later, Weiss was appointed special counsel. He then indicted Hunter on these gun charges. A few months after that, Weiss separately brought tax charges against Hunter in California. That case is scheduled to go to trial in September. Now, Hunter's attorney, Abby Lowell, has argued that these gun offenses are usually not charged, and he's argued that the special counsel has folded, essentially, to Republican pressure on the Hill, and that this whole prosecution is politically motivated.
There is quite the political backdrop for this trial, the son of a president going on trial as his father runs for re-election. I mean, could this possibly hurt President Biden?
Well, look, it comes at a tricky time for the president politically, of course. We're just, what, 5 months out from the election. Republicans have certainly in the past tried to play up Hunter's legal troubles, his international business dealings, in an effort to muddy his father. And there's every reason to believe that they're going to try to do that with this trial again. But Hunter, of course, is the one on trial, not President Biden. Hunter is not running for president. And of course, the man who is running against Biden for the presidency, former President Trump, was just found guilty by a jury in New York of falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to an adult film star. But Trump is still leading Biden in many polls. So it's hard to say what the political impact, if any, Hunter's legal troubles will have on his father's political fortunes. We're going to have to wait and see. Hunter's trial, though, opens today with jury selection, and this trial could last up to 2 weeks.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
More than 23 million low-income households are losing federal financial support for internet service. Funding has run out, and lawmakers haven't agreed on a fix. Sarah Jane Tribble with our partner KFF Health News met a woman affected at a remote ranch in southeastern Idaho.
Myrna Bronco broke her leg during the COVID pandemic. Trying to fix a shed for her horses and cows, she was standing on a ladder, pushing down on a drill, and it slipped.
And I fell, and my leg got caught in those rails and busted it, and my bone was sticking out. And the only thing was holding it was my sock.
The 69-year-old arm crawled back to the house.
Why didn't you take a phone with you?
I never really dealt with phones. I never thought nothing of it.
Bronco hasn't really needed a smartphone or the internet. Her entire life is right here on the Fort Hall Reservation. For her, the most important connection has always been to this land. But things are changing. Matthew Rantanen explains.
The society has converted everything to be online. You cannot be in this society and operate without connection to broadband.
Rantanen is director of technology for the Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association. He also runs training workshops for tribes working to get broadband on their land. Healthcare, banking, applications for jobs or benefits, they're all online.
All of those things keep Myrna at a disadvantage if she doesn't have a connection to that broadband, right?
But for the last year, Bronco has had a good internet connection with help from the subsidy. Living on tribal land, she qualifies for a $75 break, and that covers her whole bill. Those discounts ended in May. On Capitol Hill, Senator John Thune from South Dakota joined other Republicans in saying the Affordable Connectivity Program allows too many people to qualify for the discounts.
ACP does a poor job of directing support to those who truly need it.
When I asked Bronco if she could keep the internet without the subsidy, she hesitated.
I'm going to have to. It's one of my necessities.
After breaking her leg, Bronco needed 9 surgeries. She used her internet to keep track of medical records, email doctors, and to book appointments. Bronco says she may need to sign on for a slower plan to keep getting the internet. In Idaho, I'm Sarah Jane Tribble.
She's with our partner, KFF Health News. This is NPR News.
Here in the San Francisco Bay Area and the Sacramento Valley, KQED Public Radio at 6:19. I'm Dave Freeman. Coming up on Monday, Brian Watt with your KQED News ahead at 6:22. Let's take a look at traffic conditions now on Monday with the Bay Bridge again and Mel Baker.
Where the metering lights are on, the backup is past the overcrossing and moving toward the maze already this morning, which is a sign that we'll probably have a fairly normal traffic morning. In Napa, Highway 121 westbound between Highway 29 and Old Sonoma Road, that is already slow. And, of course, we're seeing the usual stop-and-go traffic in Vallejo on 37 westbound between Mare Island Bridge and the Lane Merge. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Save the Bay, imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive. The future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at SaveSFBayNow.org. The Asian Art Museum, Phoenix Kingdoms, the last splendor of China's Bronze Age, uses digital technologies to reimagine a culture buried by imperial history for centuries. Tickets at AsianArt.org. Join us for Forum at 9 on KQED. Coming up first, a new book considers the promise and peril of medicinal psychedelics. Join us for more as we learn about this at a retreat in the Amazon. We're going to talk with the author. That's on Forum at 9, then at 10.
I'm Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., former White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki joins us to share the communication strategies and methods she learned in her rise to the most powerful communications role in the nation. Psaki says these strategies are applicable whether you're speaking to voters, the president, or a preschooler. Her new book is Say More. Join us, Forum, 10 a.m. on KQED.
Bay Area, look for some cloud cover today. Highs in the 60s to the upper 80s. It gets hot starting tomorrow around the Bay Area, tomorrow and Wednesday. Tomorrow's highs start to rise in the 70s to the upper 90s. Sacramento Valley today, 80 to 88. Tomorrow, 98 to 104, possibly. Support for NPR comes from Acorn TV, with stories from all around the world in one place. From dramas to mysteries to comedies, Acorn TV offers multiple ways to stream. Subscription options at acorn.tv. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. And Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. And you can learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners of KQED, it's 622.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. The financial outlook for Bay Area transit agencies is still pretty rocky. They haven't recovered from the pandemic. And this year, state lawmakers were trying to move forward a bill for a regional tax that would have given transit a lifeline. But the proposal ultimately died. To break all of this down, we're joined by KQED's Dan Brecky. Dan, hello.
Hi, Brian.
So, you know, I take BART and buses my fair share, and I've noticed more people on them, but how bad is the financial picture of Bay Area transit agencies?
Well, you're right. People are coming back to transit, but they're coming back very slowly. BART still has fewer than 45% of the riders that it did before March 2020, and that's a big problem for that particular agency because passengers used to pay most of the bills for running the system day to day. And you see that same picture elsewhere, although most agencies like Muni and AC Transit have recovered more riders. They're in their 70 to 80% range. But overall, the recovery has been slow. And because of that, the finances of these agencies are just a mess.
And so Bay Area lawmakers proposed a bill to fund transit agencies here. And it actually got a lot of opposition from some of the agencies themselves. Why is that?
What we're talking about here is a bill that would authorize a regional vote in the 9 Bay Area counties, right? That was the original idea. And in the South Bay, the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority, which is the county's only transit agency, is really dependent on sales taxes that voters down there have passed to support its operations. And some of the sales taxes are actually supporting other operations as well. For instance, BART operations in Santa Clara County. And so when they see another sales tax coming down the road, they go, wait a minute, you may be undercutting our ability to reauthorize the taxes we're depending on right now. And that same issue has emerged for some other agencies. For instance, SMART in the North Bay is facing a sales tax vote in coming years, so they're not crazy about the idea of having a competing sales tax measure on any ballot.
In what way does this outcome say something about how challenging addressing transit in the state legislature can be?
Well, it's a very difficult process. And what makes it even harder is deciding exactly what a tax measure like this would pay for. One possibility would be to simply address the huge deficits that agencies like BART and Muni are facing in the next few years. But the thinking is that voters need to have some guarantee that the system we have is going to work a lot better if they're going to sink billions of dollars into it.
You have been reporting on transit for many years. What questions has this latest story raised for you about what's next?
What we've seen in this process so far this year with the transit tax legislation is that there are some really deep local divisions about how that money should be handled. And it's not clear whether people are going to stick to those local divisions, insist on getting what they want in their locality above what might be best for the entire region, or whether there will be some spirit of compromise.
KQED's Dan Brecky, thank you.
You're welcome, Brian.
While the A's are on their way out of Oakland, the B's are on their way in. The Oakland Ballers play their first home game tomorrow at Raimondi Park in West Oakland. And as KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman reports, getting there without a car is highly encouraged.
Still a lot of construction sites, so just be careful as you're walking through.
Crews are putting the finishing touches on the ballpark, including new parking lots.
How many parking spaces?
It's about 1,000 in total. Yeah.
That's Ballers co-founder Paul Friedman. While there's plenty of parking, the team's goal is that at least a quarter of fans will get here without a car. In upcoming seasons, the hope is that number will double. Friedman says the reasons behind their transit goals are both climate conscious and practical.
We've been told by people who do parking and transportation management for the city that if we didn't do anything, it could be as many as, you know, 80 to 90% of people would drive.
Translation? Traffic. Friedman says he's met with neighborhood groups about that.
And we heard tremendous excitement about the idea of activating this park with baseball. And then, you know, concerns about parking and transportation traffic. And, you know, the best way to solve those problems is to encourage people to use other methods.
The city has repaved the streets and sidewalks around Raimondi and removed out-of-use train tracks to make it easier to get around on two wheels or on foot. On game days, the Ballers are running a free shuttle service to the ballpark from West Oakland BART, a distance of nearly a mile. The team's also providing a free bike and scooter valet, and they're encouraging people to use AC Transit. A few blocks away from Raimondi is Kilovolt Coffee. Andrea Malaya is the manager, and she takes the bus to work.
I'd say plan time wisely, because sometimes things get kind of dicey as far as buses even like arriving on schedule.
There are four AC Transit routes that will get you within walking distance of the ballpark. But riders like Malaya could be waiting for a bus 15 minutes to a half hour, depending on the day.
I really think that there just needs to be a lot of, like, an increase in routes and service if people are going to find that option to even be viable or appealing.
Brian Culbertson is a traffic safety advocate, and he lives in the neighborhood around Raimondi Park. He says whether people walk or bike to the game is going to be based on safety.
If you have a lot of people on game day driving here, then you have a lot more people with cars interacting with people walking and biking.
He says as the neighborhood sees an influx of people, the city needs to redesign streets in ways that make it harder for drivers to speed. Speeding accounts for a quarter of deadly crashes in Oakland.
The area should be at least traffic calmed enough so that people walking and biking feel safe around an impatient driver who's trying to get to a game.
The Ballers' home opener is sold out, and that means 4,000 people are heading to Raimondi one way or another. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt, planning to try to take the bus to the game tomorrow night. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Well, let's find out about buses and traffic. Here's Mel at 629.
And it's the Altamont Pass, which is always the big slowdown. Westbound 205 is pretty much stop and go from Magley Road to 580. 580, it stays slow to stop and go out to North Flynn Road. There's a high wind advisory through the pass, which is, of course, been contributing to the Corral Hollow fire, which primarily now is closing Corral Hollow Road in both directions between the county line and 580. 580, though, is open again. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction. Support for KQED comes from UCSF Health. Excellent health care should have no boundaries. That's why UCSF Health is spreading its love to more patients in more neighborhoods across the city. To learn more, visit ucsfhealth.org/with love. More Monday morning news from NPR and KQED News straight ahead now on KQED Public Radio. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning at 6:30.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Jury selection begins today in Delaware in Hunter Biden's federal trial on gun charges. The president's son faces up to 25 years in prison if convicted on all three felony counts. Last year, a judge rejected a plea deal from prosecutors. Dr. Anthony Fauci is scheduled to appear before a House committee today. Fauci helped to oversee the federal government's response to COVID-19 and served as chief medical advisor to President Biden before retiring. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, the committee is investigating the origins of the coronavirus.
House Republicans have been investigating Grant's emails and connections between government scientists and an organization called EcoHealth Alliance, which was working in China when the pandemic began. Earlier this month, the Biden administration suspended EcoHealth's funding because of Grant irregularities found by the committee. Fauci will likely get a lot of pointed questions about any connections he had to EcoHealth, but many scientists say these lawmakers are looking at the wrong thing. Michael Warby is an expert in virus origin at the University of Arizona.
This select subcommittee could have used its powers to actually try to understand the scientific evidence.
He says probing old grant applications is unlikely to show how the pandemic actually began. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. State fire officials say yesterday, slowdown in the wind and milder weather helped fire crews make progress in containing the Corral fire near Tracy. The fire grew quickly on Saturday due to gusts of up to 45 miles an hour. Nathan Rick is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Sacramento.
In the evenings, we typically get the Delta breeze going, and then there's some terrain, you know, just to the east of that San Jose area. And so you get some of that downsloping to increase those winds, and then that just kind of contributes to stronger winds that we saw last night.
The fire pushed scores of families from their homes, destroyed one home, injured two firefighters, and burned more than 14,000 acres. CAL FIRE says it's now 50% contained. The arraignment of three City of Alameda police officers charged with involuntary manslaughter in the 2021 death of Oakland resident Mario Gonzalez was postponed last week because one of the officers is living in South Africa. The Alameda County Superior Court approved the two-month postponement to give Officer Eric McKinley time to move with his family back to the Bay Area and defend himself in court. Allison Barry Wilkinson is an attorney for one of the officers. She says Officer McKinley went to South Africa last December to work as a missionary.
Everyone would like this case to proceed forward expeditiously, but the circumstances were such that everyone was in agreement.
If convicted, the officers face up to 4 years in prison. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from the San Francisco Symphony. Shekukana Mason performs Shostakovich's Cello Concerto No. 1, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen, June 13th to the 15th. Tickets available at sfsymphony.org.
On the next California Report, school board members across the state are facing recall elections after receiving backlash for enacting trans notification policies and restricting the use of certain flags on campuses. I'm Maddie Bolaños. More on that next time on the California Report.
We'll hear more later in the hour, of course, at 6:51 a.m. coming up with Maddie, and also an update later this morning on KQED at 8:51 a.m. Bay Area, morning clouds today. Again, 60s or so near the water, upper 80s inland. Hotter temperatures arrive tomorrow, officially with highs in the 80s to the upper 90s, even hotter on Wednesday. Support for NPR comes from Bank of America, offering access to resources and digital tools designed to help local to global companies make moves for their businesses. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. And by Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. More at indeed.com/NPR and the listeners of KQED.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Another state is making a bid at regulating the global business of the Internet. Texas and Florida made an effort now before the Supreme Court to force social media companies to carry content they object to. Now, New York State is moving to legislate social media for kids. The U.S. Surgeon General last year issued a warning about the mental health risks of social media for kids, and now Governor Kathy Hochul is leading a push to limit the use of social media algorithms on kids in New York.
Our first bill is called the Save for Kids Act, which will restrict these addictive features on social media, tell the companies that they have a responsibility to monitor the content. You're not able to just keep sending the content. It has to be welcomed by the young people. They have to want this, and to find other ways to get them information. We're not banning young people from social media. Not at all. We're simply saying that they should not be bombarded with these feeds that can be sorted a different way and not in a way that is so negative for them.
I'm trying to figure out how that works in practice. If you pick something like Instagram, which I'm on, I mean, I get a bunch of things from people that I follow. There's a particular algorithm. It may also suggest things for me to look at. What would you force Instagram to change if they're going to do business in New York State?
For young people, instead of this algorithmic feed, minors would receive a feed where updates from other users they follow are sorted chronologically or in some other way that's not relying on their personal information. That it's just a different group of individuals under age 18 that you cannot use the normal business practice of continuing to send information that is unsolicited.
And how do you determine that it is a young person under a certain age who is using the phone at that point?
Well, that's exactly what we're focused on because it's easy to evade. But, you know, for example, young people are not able to go to online gambling sites. There are ways to restrict based on not just age, but other information that I think is essential, that this information be provided, that we know who the young people are, that the companies know who they are, and they'll be held responsible if they continue the practices that they're on right now.
Does somebody have to provide an ID?
We're working on exactly how we would make that happen.
I think this is a point of debate, though, isn't it? That when you begin saying, I need an ID requirement, the people who object are not necessarily parents of kids, but other people who will say, I want to be on the internet and doing what I'm doing, and I don't want to have to show my ID because that's really intrusive for me.
I'm talking about protecting young people, teenagers, who should not be subjected to information that is negative, that is having a detrimental effect on their mental health. And we have to figure out a way, and we're smart enough to do this. And I know the companies know how to do this. Some of them are being cooperative, and others just want to continue their business practice because it's about commercial profit and gain for them. And they should not be collecting and selling personal information from young people.
Do companies, when you talk with them, raise another objection, that they're a global business, they're a national business, and it is difficult for them if every single state has its own particular regulations?
Well, I would say this, it does call for a federal response. That's the way I believe that this should occur. But in the absence of this level of responsibility, if you talk to the CEOs of these companies, they know what they're doing. They don't let their own children engage in these social media sites until they're much older. So why is everyone else having to be subjected to this? And they know how to stop this. So we're saying, come to the table, work with us. You know, we're not hostile to tech here in the state of New York. We are very pro-tech. And social media has an incredible side that is very positive. I'm talking about the fact that I, as the leader of this state, cannot ignore the signs of distress and trauma among our young people. And it's definitely correlated to what is happening with these social media feeds. And we have to do something and not just say, well, it's too hard to do, therefore we won't.
Governor Kathy Hochul of New York, it's always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
For the last month, Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv, has faced near daily strikes from Russia. The border is about 20 miles away. A change in U.S. policy could make it safer for now, but did the change come too late? NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kharkiv.
The day Russian bombs hit the home improvement center where Victoria Kitsenko works, she was reviewing orders for wallpaper. She felt a hot blast. The roof caved in. She wiped blood off her face as she forced her way outside. In the parking lot, she saw the bodies of her coworkers and a thick black plume of smoke rising over her hometown.
What's happening in Kharkiv now? It's just destruction, destruction of the city and destruction of Kharkiv's citizens. The Russians want our city, an empty city.
After nearly a month of escalating Russian attacks on Kharkiv, the White House said last week that it will allow Ukraine to fire some U.S.-provided weapons into Russia, but only across the border from the Kharkiv region. In the Saltivka neighborhood, not far from the home improvement store that was hit, Svetlana Poznikina says she's waiting to see if it will make a difference.
It's very bad here right now. A lot of people have left the neighborhood. Half the houses are empty. In my apartment building, it's only retirees who have run out of money and have nowhere to go.
Poznikina, who is 55 and works in a candy store, says her blue-collar neighborhood has long been in the line of fire. Russian forces pummeled Saltivka's high-rises, markets, and parks as they tried to occupy Kharkiv at the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 2022. And they have struck it repeatedly after launching a new offensive in the Kharkiv region last month. Poznikina says that Western words of support have not seemed to have translated into protection from the bombs.
The longer there's delay in weapons or action, the more the fighting seems to increase and the more missiles are launched at us. So we feel abandoned.
Another Saltivka resident, 31-year-old Tatiana Kovalenko, says the Russian strikes have not stopped since the U.S. allowed Ukraine to strike Russia with Western weapons. It's restless here, very restless, she says. They hit us everywhere. We live on the 16th floor so we can see what comes in and where it hits. She's 8 months pregnant. She says she and her family spend every night in the bomb shelter. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has brought up Kharkiv repeatedly when pleading with the U.S. and other allies to give Ukrainian troops more leverage in using Western weapons. In Singapore this weekend, Zelensky said he's seeking the use of long-range weapons like ATACMS to hit Russian military targets currently beyond their reach.
So they have these weapons there and they do not remove them because they know that Ukraine cannot target them with Western weaponry, even if they fire against us.
Back in Saltivka, there's a memorial at what's left of the Home Improvement Center. 19 people were killed here, including Victoria Kitsenko's boss. Kitsenko says she was so shaken by the attack that she has now left Kharkiv. She is not sure she will return. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kharkiv.
This is NPR News.
Time is 6:43 on Monday. Let's find out about traffic out in the Bay Area. Here again is Mel.
In the Richmond San Rafael Bridge, traffic is now stop and go between Castro Street to the Toll Plaza. It's stop and go up in Napa as well on 121 westbound between Highway 29 and Old Napa Road. Nearly stop traffic heading on 37 westbound between Wilson and the Lane Merge as you head out toward the raceway, where you'll encounter some slow traffic and 30-minute delays on ACE train number 1 from Stockton to San Jose. Mel Baker for KQED.
And support for KQED comes from UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. More at ucse.edu. It's a perspective now on KQED at 6:43. Where do our lost things go? And will we meet them again in this life or the next? With more, here's Paul Staley.
If there is an afterlife, I have a request. Of course, I want to see all the people I've loved who have passed on before me, but I'd also like a reunion with all the things I've lost along the way. We'll need a pretty big room. There'll be a big mound of golf balls and a large assortment of unmatched socks, hats, clothing, sunglasses, keys. The list of invitees will be long. These were all things that at one time were possessions of mine, although my grip proved not that tight. Their hold on me, however, was never stronger than when I couldn't find them. It'll be an emotional occasion. I still miss some of them, and I imagine there'll be hard feelings on their part. Why wasn't I more careful, less absent-minded? I'll tell them how much I beat myself up about their disappearance, but in the end, that can't change the outcome. I will ask what happened after we parted ways. Perhaps they wound up belonging to somebody who took better care of them. I hope so. I'd hate to think of all of them heading straight to a landfill. Our relationship was always a two-way street. Yes, I got use out of them, but it was me who released them from the limbo of inventory and gave them a role in the world. But in the end, there will be no avoiding this awkward question. Did I ever replace them? For some, the answer will be yes, and I hope that answer is taken as evidence of their importance and not an indication that they are mere commodities. For the rest, there may be a brief surge of pride that comes from being labeled irreplaceable. And that could soon be followed by this troubling thought. Perhaps I decided that I didn't really need them. Possession, after all, is often the result of appetite and desire and not necessity. And this reckoning of whether you need something or merely like it is something that ought to be done in this life and not in whatever comes next. With a perspective, this is Paul Staley.
Paul Staley lives in San Francisco, and you can hear more stories like Paul's on our podcast. Just search KQED's Perspectives on your favorite podcast app. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and providing financial donations to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Sacramento Valley, cloudy skies today, highs warmer, 80 to 88. If that's not hot enough for you, try tomorrow. Highs supposed to range from 98 to 104 in the Sacramento Valley. Heat warning begins tomorrow at 11 a.m. officially. For the Bay Area, it warms up starting tomorrow. Today's highs with some cloud cover, mid-60s to the low 80s. Support for NPR comes from your part-time controller, U.S.-based staff helping nonprofits with their accounting, from bookkeeping to financial reporting and analysis to CFO services, yptc.com/NPR. Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort, AlignProbiotics.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Singapore over the weekend trying to rally support for a global peace conference he's organizing in Switzerland. But one powerful Asian country is likely not attending, and that's China. NPR's Emily Fang was in Singapore as well following all of this. Emily, Zelensky wants countries in Asia to attend a Swiss peace conference, but he called out China in particular. What did he say?
He came up pretty strongly against China. He was in Singapore for this defense summit over the weekend, and his words were a pretty big contrast when you consider China was once Ukraine's biggest trading partner before Russia's full-scale invasion 2 years ago. So Zelensky said he'd been unable to get a meeting with Chinese officials who were in Singapore. China says it's neutral on this war. But then Zelensky alleged this. He said, quote, Russia, using Chinese influence in the region, is using Chinese diplomats and does everything it can to disrupt the peace summit. And he said this is unfortunate that such a, quote, big, independent, powerful country as China is an instrument in the hands of Vladimir Putin, Russia's leader. Zelensky also said China was helping to block other countries from attending the summit, though he did not offer details on exactly how.
Wow. Okay. So how did China respond then?
China's foreign ministry today totally denied this. They said they were an impartial party to this conflict, but they've already signaled they are not going to come to the peace summit because Russia is not invited. And I asked several Chinese military officials at this defense summit about why. One said they felt without Russia, the summit just felt like this one-sided exercise to rile up international politics. And here's another official, Senior Colonel Zhang Qi, who teaches at the Military National Defense College in Beijing. He says China has put forth numerous peace proposals, but it is the U.S. and other large countries that are provoking and fanning the flames of more tension. Now, many countries would disagree with this, but it shows how even with conflicts happening far away from Asia, in the Middle East, in Ukraine and Russia, Asian countries, where I'm based, feel impacted, and they're being called on to choose a side, including in the U.S.-China rivalry that runs through many of these conflicts.
And I understand the issue of Taiwan came up quite a bit during this security conference this weekend as well, and China's defense minister spoke out very strongly against international support for Taiwan.
Yeah, so China just had these big military drills around Taiwan, and China's defense minister delivered an address condemning all of Taiwan's leadership, warning that China was prepared to act if, per its account, there is what he calls more foreign interference encouraging Taiwanese independence. But China was also trying to turn down the temperature, and Chinese military officials at this defense summit I was at said they thought his pretty fiery speech was actually a signal that China does not want to fight over Taiwan. Here's Major General Xu Hui, who is president of the International Defense Studies Department at China's National Defense University. So she says to maintain the One China principle, that basically Taiwan is part of China, that's the only way East Asian peace can be maintained, and they would like to see the U.S.'s behavior match its rhetoric. But the problem is, these are demands that are mostly unacceptable to Taiwanese society, so there's a high likelihood tensions are only going to worsen rather than calm down.
NPR's Emily Fang. Thanks a lot, Emily.
Thanks, A.
This is NPR News.
There's a crash on the Altamont Pass. Let's get details now.
It's in the eastbound direction on 580 before Grant Line Road. Traffic is slow back to about North Flynn Road. The three left lanes are blocked by a two-car crash. Now, the westbound direction is, of course, our commute direction. 205 itself is stop and go on the Tracy side from about Magley Road to 580, and then 580 westbound remains slow to stop and go out to North Flynn Road. A high wind advisory through the pass as well. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Sutter Health. From 34 joint replacement centers to 5 cardiovascular surgery centers, Sutter never stops helping patients get back on their feet. More at sutterhealth.org. And support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers. Introducing the Kia EV9, an all-electric three-row SUV with available sound insulating glass and technologies that help reduce cabin noise. More at kia.com.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Madi Bolaños in San Francisco, and today we're devoting the whole show to school boards. Here, I'll explain. Republicans in California have struggled to gain power at the state capitol, but they've found more success recently on school boards. Conservatives have made gains in these local seats, but now they're facing pushback in the form of recall elections, including two underway right now in Riverside County and the Bay Area. KQED's Guy Maserati is here to tell us more. Hey, Guy.
Hey, Madi.
So what are the issues driving these recall campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think stepping back, just school boards, we've seen them become highly politicized across the country and in California, despite nominally being a nonpartisan office. But we've seen conservatives win seats on school boards and then pass policies at that local level that they could not get passed statewide. Things like restrictions on flags in response to efforts to fly the pride flag, things like transgender reporting policies, requiring teachers to tell students' parents when the kid has to be identified with a name or with a pronoun that's different than that's on their birth certificate. And these board trustees will say, like, this is the platform that we ran on, but those policies have definitely angered a lot of parents, residents, teachers, and now we're seeing organized pushback in the form of these recall elections. It started in March this year. We saw two conservative board members recalled in Orange County, another outside of Sacramento, and now we have two recall elections coming up. There's one in Sunol on the outskirts of the Bay Area, and another that's happening this week in Temecula, and my colleague Madison Amen at KVCR has been following that.
More than 100 people gathered on a busy street corner in Temecula one recent Saturday morning to defend Joseph Komorowski. He was there too, in his cowboy hat and boots. He waved a vote no on the recall sign. Other signs demanded protection for parental rights. That's an idea Komorowski says is central to his mission.
Parental rights is they have the authority over their children, not a school, not a county, not the state, not the United States. It's a God-given right.
To that end, since the board appointed him as president, Komorowski has pushed controversial measures like banning critical race theory, something that was never taught in the district. He championed a policy to require schools to notify parents if their child identifies as transgender. He says his policies all have the same goal.
If I were to boil down my message all into one, protecting innocence of children.
Under Komorowski, the board also gave itself broad powers to ban books it deems obscene.
He, you know, stands up for the rights that we believe in.
That's Vicky Koppel, who was at the rally and sums up what a lot of his supporters say.
We don't want boys in the girls' bathrooms or locker rooms, and we want him to represent us.
Meanwhile, others want Komorowski out.
I'm here about the recall election. Do you know about the recall?
A group of parents, teachers, and community members with a PAC called One Temecula Valley has spent months knocking on doors to get people to mark yes on their recall ballots.
Are you mailing it in or dropping it off? You're mailing it in. Perfect. Okay.
The PAC had wanted to recall all three conservative Temecula school board members, but they only got enough signatures for Komorowski. Jeff Pack, who helps lead One Temecula Valley, says that's okay because Komorowski has whipped up a firestorm.
His demeanor and behavior, it's just, it no way fits the position, and you can see the damage being done on day one.
Pack says he wants to, quote, make Temecula boring again. And by getting Komorowski off the board,
most of the radical stuff won't happen.
Many teachers in the district say that radical stuff has made it hard to teach. Susan Allen has lived in Temecula for years and works at an elementary school.
I worry for my teacher friends that are looking over their shoulder. They're afraid what to say in their classroom.
Whether Komorowski keeps or loses his position, three other seats on the board are up for election in November. People on both sides of the recall say they expect the vote tomorrow will be a good predictor of how those races will go. It could be a while before Temecula is boring again. For the California Report, I'm Madison Ament in Temecula.
And Guy Maserati is still with us. Guy, is this trend of recalling conservative school board members something new?
Yeah, I mean, there have been recalls in the past, but I do think the quick succession of these elections, the fact that they touch on a lot of similar issues, you know, that critics say are harming LGBTQ students, it does make it feel a little bit different. And I also think it's worth noting that, you know, we've seen a rise of high-profile recalls in recent years in California, but they've largely been to remove Democrats and remove progressives like Gavin Newsom, liberal district attorneys, even the school board members who were recalled in San Francisco. The fact that these recalls are going after conservative board members is kind of that dynamic flipping.
And who do you see driving these recalls?
Well, we've seen parents organizing with teachers like you heard in Temecula, sometimes with the financial help from the unions that represent the teachers. And I talked to David Goldberg, who's president of the California Teachers Association. And basically, I asked him, like, why not just contest these seats at the next regularly scheduled election?
If you're a student in high school and you have policies actively targeting you and your humanity, that's your entire high school career. You don't get to wait another 4 years and say, don't worry.
Now, conservatives see this differently. They say this is simply a case of powerful unions who did not like recent election results, didn't like who ended up on the school board, and are now trying to engineer a different result in special elections.
So, Guy, what are your big takeaways from your reporting on this?
Well, I think this, you know, organized pushback that we're seeing to these conservative board members was not necessarily a given a year ago. There were a lot of questions about how opponents of these board members were going to respond. We'll have to see how the results shake out in Temecula this week and in Sonoma next month. But I do think regardless of the results, it's clear that opponents of these conservative board members have had a bit of a wake-up call. You know, they're now vowing to take these school board seats more seriously, contest them in general elections. And oh, by the way, Republican officials I talked to said they're just as committed to winning these seats in the future. So I think you can expect this fight to continue, perhaps escalate as we move towards November.
That's KQED politics correspondent Guy Maserati. Guy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Madi.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at Irvine.org. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy includes Schmidt Ocean Institute, advancing the frontiers of ocean science, exploration, and discovery, on the web at SchmidtOcean.org.
And that's the California Report for Monday, June 3rd. We're a production of KQED Public Radio.